ICQ Podcast, episode 426, Ham Psy Eclipse. Well, hello fellow amateur and radio enthusiasts, and welcome to this, the 426th episode of the ICQ Amateur and Radio Podcast, supported in this episode by Winston Lawrence, KD2, Whiskey Lima Lima, and Martin Malley, Whiskey Kilo Zero Echo, along with our monthly annual subscription donors. In this episode, we join Martin, MNRB, Dan, KB6 November Uniform, Karen, KD2 Golf Uniform Tango, Edmund, Mike Zero, Mike November Golf, and Ed, DD5 Lima Papa, to discuss the latest amateur ham radio news. Myself, Colin, M6BLY, rounds up the news in brief, and this episode's feature is a feature discussing the Ham Psy Eclipse events that are coming up over the coming weeks. Well, as always, it's your very kind generosity and your donations and showing the value for what we do to keep your amateur ham radio podcast here at the ICQ Podcast advert-free and produced every fortnight. We'd like to first thank Martin Malley for his one-off donation. Martin's call sign is Whiskey Kilo Zero Echo, and he says he really appreciates hearing from all the international collection of amateurs discussing the news and the projects related to the hobby. So thanks there, Martin, for your very kind support. And Winston Lawrence, KD2 Whiskey Lima Lima, also comes in for the donation. He says he's glad to help out. Always enjoy listening to the podcast, which is its own unique format. Enjoy hearing the news segment with the accompanying variety of opinions and what everyone's been up to, and the closing wrap-up topic from the podcast. Thank you all for your hard work. It's appreciated. So thank you to Martin, Winston, and all the donors for this episode, all the monthly subscription donors. Without you, we really couldn't pay our way and do the show for you. Now, if we show value for you, all you have to do is do what the guys did. They went to icqpodcast.com/donate. They selected a monetary figure that reflected their value they received from the show, sent it along our way, and as I say, we've pumped that into the show to help pay our bills, pay our way, and keep everything going for you. So it's a lovely way the whole circle comes together. Right, well, we're going to work that value for you by joining Martin, Dan, Karen, Edmund, and Ed to discuss, generate thoughts about the latest amateur ham radio news, including getting ready to support the Eclipse operations and smart radio heats up libraries. As always, hope you enjoy.
Hi ICQ listeners, this is Ed, DD5LP, to tell you about ICQ Live. ICQ Live is an event that we're planning to happen in April on the 13th, and it's an opportunity for you as listeners to become part of the show itself, to ask your questions of the presenters, and also to perhaps tell us a little bit about what you're doing, your projects, and your concerns in the hobby. So please look at the website, icqpodcast.com, for the full details, and hopefully we'll hear you there on April the 13th. Bye for now.
Well, hi guys, welcome to episode 462 of the ICQ Podcast and tonight's news roundtable for that episode. Tonight I'm joined by Mr. Dan Romanchek, KB6NU. Hi Dan.
Good evening everyone.
Good evening Dan, and not long before you and I get together in Dayton, so looking forward to that.
You and me both.
Yeah, that'll be a good one. We also, your side of the pond, have Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT. Hi, Karen.
Good evening, Martin, and good evening to our listeners.
Yeah, good evening to you, and a pleasure to have you with us again. This country, back in the UK, I have Mr. Edmund Spicer, M0MMG. Hi, Edmund.
Hello, Martin. Hello, everybody.
Yeah, good to have you, Edmund, and I'm sure you'll tell us what you've been up to today when it comes to the end, and go from there. So I know you've been busy today. Last but not least, going over to Germany, we have Mr. Ed Durant, DD5LP. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, stealing another famous podcaster's expression, good evening, morning and afternoon to all listeners.
Yeah, yeah, they listen all sorts of times, as you well know. The same with the ICQ podcast talk group. You know, there's people on at various times, and I look and think, I wasn't up that time, but it seems to be active all the time, which is good. Right, let's move to our first news story. And this one is about Ham Psy, and Amateur Radio stands ready to support the Eclipse operation. So on the 8th of April 2024, there's going to be a full eclipse of the sun across the US. Dan, do you want to go first on this one?
Sure. So this is yet another operation by HAMSCI, the Ham Radio Science. I forget what SCI stands for, but they're using doing citizen science basically, and they're enlisting ham radio operators again to operate during the solar eclipse to see what effect the solar eclipse has on HF propagation. And I certainly plan to be on the air during the eclipse. And what they do basically is they gather information from reverse beacon network and other online, contact collection sites. And then they correlate that with the eclipse. So, like I say, I plan to be on the air and operate during that solar eclipse.
Yeah, that'll be a good one, Dan, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Karen, are you going to be active while this is happening?
Absolutely. It's easy enough to do. All you have to do is get on the air. I'd be crazy not to be a part of this. It's very exciting. And, you know, thinking about it, you're doing what you do as a ham, and you're assisting in a very important data gathering effort. They did a great job back at the end of last year with the annular eclipse. And the folks at HAMSCI are slowly releasing chunks and chunks of data about what they found during that event. Now, this is a total eclipse, so this is going to yield vastly different results, I'm sure, in different parts of the country. So it'll be interesting to be able to compare that. But what a great, hardworking group of folks. Absolutely. We'll do anything and everything to help in this effort. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah. So it sounds good. And at least we are getting to see some of the data that we sent them after they've processed it. Edmund, I know this is happening in the States, but I'm sure maybe they'd like a log from us people over in the UK.
Well, I was aware that this was coming up, but I hadn't paid an awful lot of attention to it because I'm not located in the US until last week when the latest copy of RADCOM dropped on my doormat. And there's a little article at the bottom of page 14, I think it is from memory, where somebody associated with the RSGB Propagation Studies Board has suggested that amateurs in the UK and Europe could transmit whisper on the 15, 12, and 10 meter bands, whereby a multiple hop would be required to get across the Atlantic, and the effects of the eclipse could perhaps be seen and felt on the second or third of those hops. And this is something that I think I'm going to try. I don't have a dedicated antenna for any of those bands, but I do have a 40 meter inverted V dipole fed with coax in the center, and that works very, very well on 15 meters as a 3/2 wavelengths antenna with a bit of persuasion from an antenna matching unit. And my first thought was I could use my Whisper Flexi, which only transmits whisper. But with further thought, I think it would be better if I actually had my transceiver switched on and connected to the internet. So not only do I transmit it, but I also receive it as well and upload the results from that to the internet. And the suggestion in RADCOM is that if you're going to do that, you do it on the 7th and the 9th of April, as well as just the 8th. So I hadn't thought of that, and I'm quite pleased because even though I'm in the wrong continent for the eclipse, that suggestion is something practical that I can do and that hopefully many other people in the UK and Europe will have a go at doing as well. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's say at least you're going to have some fun, and I'm going to try and get on as well, see what I can do. But that'll be interesting. Ed, I know when we were starting, you said that you'd be a bit interested in this, and they're having a workshop, but unfortunately it happens, the workshop happens the weekend we release the podcast, so most of you are going to miss it. But don't worry, I did record a feature with the guys, so they'll give you a bit. Gary will give you a bit more information. But are you going to get involved in this, Ed?
Well, I had the same feeling as Edmund to start with, thinking, you know, I'm not in the US, I'm not under the eclipse, so therefore, what good am I going to be doing going on the air unless I send them a login, and then you've got to get the right format and all sent in and da 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 da. It's too much trouble. But then as Edmund's just described, of course, running something like Whisper, or in fact any of the digital modes that writes back to pskreporter.info, although I think there's another site as well, but that's the usual one people usually send the data to. Yeah, it should be doable. And of course then they'll also get comparisons of people outside of the US and people in the US. So, you know, that comparison value is there as well. So yeah, I'll consider it, but I've got so many other things going on around that time that I'm probably not going to take part. But it's valid that everybody knows that they can take part and be valuable in these sort of exercises. Yeah, if you're running CW, the reverse beacon network picks you up, then you're helping. If you're in a digital mode and somebody's got a web SDR somewhere and it's picking you up and putting you into pskreporter.info, then you're helping without even knowing about it in both of those cases necessarily. Sideband, something different. You'd need to actually send a login saying what you've done and when and where and how. And yeah, Martin, you beat me to the jump. I was going to give a nice link into you to cover what the feature's going to be in this edition. But yeah, as you said, there were a couple of presentations planned, and they will have taken place, I believe, on the Friday before this edition of ICQ podcast comes out, where they were timed so that people in the UK and Europe could listen in and get information of how to take part. But as we say, listen to the feature in this week's edition and you'll get a fair bit of information there for you as well if you're interested in taking part. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, thanks, Aidan. Sorry to steal your thunder. Yeah, I had about a 25-minute chat with Gary explaining certain things and some of the findings they've had. So, if you want to hear more, so please listen to the feature at the back end of this podcast. Move to our next news story, and it said discarded space junk from the International Space Station falls to Earth without incident. Well, thank God for that, I would suggest. We don't want incidents, but this sounds like fly tipping, what we would call in the UK fly tipping, where you just throw it out the side of the road and it becomes somebody else's problem. And it sounds like they tossed out a load of rubbish from the International Space Station in 2021, and it's been on its way down ever since. What do you think, Karen?
Well, you know, this is one of my least favorite topics, space junk. More space junk. This one, lovely parcel on its way back to Earth from the International Space Station. And for a while, people in parts of Europe were concerned that it might actually land somewhere, parts of Germany or Luxembourg. So that was definitely a big concern. Clearly, it was, I guess you'd call it a safe landing, ended up in the Atlantic. Around Guatemala or Florida. So if you're a fish, you might have a problem with where it landed, but people have not been reporting any incidents. I don't know what the answer is. I really think we're putting a lot of garbage up in the sky, and it's worse when the garbage comes back. But it's important to note this. It was in free fall, and it was the largest object to ever be tossed from the ISS. So that's worth noting. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, that was a bit of a naughty one. I mean, there were 9 batteries weighing 2.6 metric ton. I mean, 2.5 ton, that's like throwing a large automobile or car out to the space station and it coming down on you. And at that sort of speed, you know, you'd be in serious problems. Edmund, what do you think about it?
Well, Karen just said she doesn't know what the answer is. You don't necessarily need to know what the answer is in order to know what the answer isn't. And doing this, I don't think is the answer. I mean, the good news is that it's now not space junk anymore, it's Earth junk. And it also landed on the ocean rather than on top of anybody's head, which is good news. The bad news is if you happen to be a fish or wildlife swimming around somewhere near where this battery crashed, good luck drinking the chemicals, and I hope you survive.
Well put. Well put. Yeah, it is a bit naughty. Ed, what's your thoughts?
Well, I'm very surprised that the ISS did this. And by rights, they should be prosecuted, be that NASA or Cosmos or whoever it is. They have supply rockets that go up. They take stuff up to the space station and they bring the rubbish back down in the rockets. Why were these thrown out 3 years ago to not only come down now, but having been hurtling around, possibly putting other satellites and other spacecraft in danger for the last 3 years? What the heck do they think they were playing at? They're not saying these are things that accidentally broke off. These were deliberately thrown waste into space, and yeah, 2.5-3 tons of battery, and you know, just crazy. You know, what the heck do the people running the space station think they're doing? Some of those parts could have fallen on me, and indeed there was a warning put out, a national warning, to be careful that, you know, if you're in certain areas like in the Alpen regions and the southern regions of Germany, near Friedrichshafen, for example, they could have hit. And the fact that that was the prediction from NASA, that they might hit there, or it could have been the ESA that made that prediction, don't know, whoever, and then they actually hit in the Caribbean, that really shows how much they were out, it was out of control, and they had no idea what was going to happen. You've got to ask how much other junk has been thrown out by the ISS and maybe the Chinese space station, maybe the Skylab before, and all the rest of it. I mean, come on, guys, get some sense. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, it's a horrible thought. I mean, we've got enough space junk up there anyway without fly tipping, is what we call it in the UK. Pretty bad. Dan, what's your thoughts?
Well, I think we should have a congressional committee investigate this. This might be more appropriate than some of the committee investigations we've had recently. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. I know it's quite loaded and we covered a lot of it, but it is quite frightening that, if I dump something at the side of the road, I can get prosecuted. If you throw something at the International Space Station, it might wipe out a small town. You don't get in trouble. So let's hope they learn from this big time. Move to our next news story. At this library, check out ham radio as well as a book. Now, Frank, our Frank K4FMH, has been working on smart radio and putting libraries, amateur radio into libraries. I've been trying to do a similar thing here in the UK. But Frank's big event happened a couple of weeks ago. And from what I can see, it was pretty much a success. Ed, do you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, will do. I mean, Frank has said this before on the editions that he's on. It's a natural joining, if you like, between libraries who are looking to give information on various subjects, but certainly technical and STEM, so STEM subjects especially, and amateur radio. And, you know, it's a good matchup, and well done on Frank for his first SMART, so it's that Saturday morning's amateur radio time session, and good luck with the next ones. And also, from what you've said before we started talking, Martin, take-up in the UK hasn't been as good as you'd hoped. Let's hope that improves as we go into spring and summer. And, you know, I think it says here the idea in the US is perhaps to have an outside event of some sort outside of the library, and that's also maybe something that might attract a few more people in the UK. Yeah, anything we can do to publicise the hobby is a good thing. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I hear where you're coming from. We've had quality, not quantity, I think we have to put it. We have had some people stay. Now one guy's done 5 hours over two sessions with us. So, that's a quality call. He's really trying to suck my brains dry, I think. But it works well. Edmund, what's your thoughts on what Frank's doing?
Very pleased that he seems to have been so successful. It's a wonderful idea, and I wish that I could do something like that locally, but thinking about the library in my own village and in the immediately adjacent villages, all of them have got virtually no real estate around them. They don't have large back gardens or enough space where you could put up a half-decent HF antenna. And even if they did, they're surrounded by other buildings, so QRM from the neighbouring buildings would probably be very high in an urban environment. So I don't really, other than just using VHF for local contacts, or maybe the ICQ podcast talk group and hotspots, that kind of thing, I think it would be quite hard to do in this country. I get the impression from what I've seen that libraries in the US tend to have sort of more space around them, if you see what I mean. But for those who manage to do it, wherever they are in the world, all power to your elbow and the very best of luck.
Yeah, that's a good one. Dan, have you seen Frank's blog on this one?
No, and I'm going to have to look that up. We've here in Ann Arbor, we've worked somewhat with the local library. The local library put up a makerspace, and I had done a few things with the makerspace, and then the makerspace has sort of had a reorganization, and I was sort of on the outs then, but. I like this approach that Frank's taking, and maybe again I'll have to look at the blog post. But maybe if there's enough of a program there, we can approach our local library and do something similar here. I'm no longer on the board of our club, but I know that the current board members have been talking to the library about some kind of cooperation, and this might be a good program for that.
Yeah, well, let's say Frank was running down there in Madison County in Mississippi as a pilot, and I know he would be more than happy for others to do it. Both Frank and I have been trying piloting things to see if we can come up with a formula that works for others. So, watch this space, I would say, guys. Karen, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, this was a story we ran on Newsline. Frank sent me a link to his blog, which I eagerly read and got very excited about it. For me, Martin, this is a true partnership. This is the essence of true partnership between libraries and amateur radio operators in the community. We see all the time these really nice stories about ham clubs donating books, technical manuals, and study guides to the library. And that's fantastic. I think that's wonderful that ham clubs can add to the collection for people who are interested in studying and maybe getting their license. Well, this really takes it many, many steps further. This is active involvement. This is not just words on a page. These are real people sharing their intelligence, their interests, their enthusiasm, their experience, and giving up a Saturday morning for a couple of hours to share with the community. Now, on top of that, the libraries have a willingness to have at least one licensed ham on staff and to have a place to operate. This is a win. I want to call it a win-win-win. It's pretty amazing. Libraries clearly are getting very progressive about amateur radio, and that's just awesome. I wish more ham clubs would seek out partnerships like this, because this is apparently a very, very big success. Back to you.
Well, Frank's done well in the States on this. I think the ethos in the States with libraries, hams and libraries, is far greater than in the UK. That's not to say that the library I'm trialling our one with, the staff are very proactive and very, very helpful. But we just haven't had as many people show an interest yet. We're doing 8 sessions. We're doing session number 5 on Saturday, the Saturday before this releases. So hopefully it'll pick up. But I think what Frank's doing is well worth doing. And if it works in the States and not in the UK, well, at least it's worked somewhere. And you've got to try. And I think this is great what Frank's doing. Right, move to our next news story. Ed, you put this one in. It's a bit long. We ain't going to read it all. But Germany celebrates 75 years of ham radio law, which is older than the country itself, you say. Go on, enlighten us, Ed.
Yeah, okay. Well, as you say, it's a very long story, because this is actually the script from, translated script from Radio DARC, which is the weekly shortwave radio program from the National Society, the National Amateur Radio Society in Germany. They kindly allowed me to take that, and we will be actually posting it up on the AR Newsline website as well. So if you don't read it in the show notes by ICQ podcast, it'll be up on arnewsline.org as well. Now, on to the story. First of all, celebrations. 75 years of amateur radio in Germany, and amateur radio with actually defined under a law. What happened after what happened in the Second World War was that all amateur radio was stopped everywhere, and it took until the end of the 40s in Germany before the consideration could be given for any amateur radio to be brought back in, so as legal radio. At that time, the interim government had the problem that they had a lot of radio stations on the air who they didn't know who they were. Whether they were, let's say, radio experimenters, radio amateurs to be, or whether they were spies. And one of the reasons that the Allied forces put together the proposal for an amateur radio license in Germany was so that they could identify who was the good guys and who were the bad guys. Because then amateur radio operators would be registered with their address and what equipment they're using, so that if a signal was heard by the military forces, they could then say, okay, all right, we know he's registered, he's a radio amateur, no problem. Or, that's a strange one, we better go investigate. Now, why was the law brought in before even the Federation of Germany happened? Prior to this time, the structure of Germany was different. It wasn't a federated country. And that was brought in after the Second World War in 1949. And thoughts were to get this act through before, because there were so many other things that needed to be done. People were basically starving. They had no housing. It was a real mess. And if this bill had been proposed after the Federation, it would have gone to the back of the queue. quite definitely. But so there was a rush to get it in before the Federation, and indeed that's what happened. The rules were based on what was effectively the ITU in those days, Guidelines for Amateur Radio, and it was brought in, put together by the French and the British forces, with the help then of obviously the German amateurs to be, and put forward. But then they had a problem that the politicians, like all politicians, were dragging their feet and not doing anything. And there was a big danger this wasn't going to get through. So this is where the story got rather interesting. As a protest action, all the radio amateurs to be were asked to send their representative a brick wrapped up and put through the post, which thousands did. The end result was that not only was the office of the politicians and the parliament overrun with bricks everywhere, but also the postal service just about ground to a halt, and indeed had to rent some more trucks to be able to move the post there. This was all legal and above board, and it had the desired effect. 3 days later, the bill was passed, and we have now the same amateur radio law. This amateur radio in law in Germany is actually different to many other countries. Most countries, the law is actually part of the Telecommunications Act or telecommunications law. In Germany, the amateur radio law is separate, and it is a primary law. That means it takes precedence over other laws. So if something's changed in the Telecommunications Act that would impact amateur radio, forget it. The amateur radio law takes precedence. So we're still in that situation, and one of the reasons the DARC has raised this story in relation to the fact that it's 75 years ago this all happened is that they are still protecting that right. They want to avoid the amateur radio law being swallowed up into the bigger Telecommunications Act, because amateur radio would lose power then, they would lose features, they would lose all kinds of different things. So 75 years ago, the amateur radio enthusiasts, or the radio experimenters, as we could call them then, did a big, big favour for amateur radio to this day in all the actions they took. Anyway, that was a long introduction, basically covered everything. And if you want all the details, though, please take the time to read the article. It's just nice to see how a legal action, can actually get politicians to move. I wish we could do that for a few of the politicians that are around today. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Interesting how they did the protest. And I think you liked the process, didn't you, Dan, where you send a brick? You know, that would have created holy havoc.
Yeah, I thought that was really great. And in fact, you know, talking about this came up recently here too amongst some of my friends, is that it would be nice to somehow be more systematic about capturing the history of ham radio. You know, this is a particular case where this was a very interesting thing that happened that amateur radio operators did, and they got the law passed. But you know, there's all kinds of other things like that I think if we don't do more, then we're going to lose all that history. And so I don't know what the solution is. And, you know, I can maybe do I have some ideas of my own about what I can do myself. But it'd be nice to have more of a systematic approach to capturing our history, I think.
Yeah, certainly would be, Dan. Certainly would be on that one. And that is interesting. Karen, what's your thoughts on this one?
This is a fascinating bit of history. And what's especially fascinating is, as Ed pointed out, this law exists outside of the framework of the telecommunications law, which makes it unusual and, I don't want to say invulnerable, but certainly gives it a bit more strength and gives it a robust nature, which hams need in these changing times with the tremendous battle for spectrum, real estate on the spectrum. I think it's, and changing technology, I think it's critical to have a law that really is standing on its own legs. I had to laugh though when I heard about the BRICS. I mean, who couldn't laugh about the BRICS? It was so effective and so beautiful and so very legal and so very nonviolent. And without naming any names, you know, in some countries the BRICS wouldn't be mailed, they'd be thrown. So how delightful and how very polite and effective to do it in such an intelligent and ultimately very effective way. So bravo. And this is certainly a celebration. Believe this will be celebrated on the air. This law will be celebrated with special event stations. So if you happen to work one of these stations, now you know why they're so happy to be on the air. And I don't know if these stations are giving QSL cards or certificates, but I think it's really neat that they're making the effort to call attention to it.
Karen, let's hope the QSL card isn't a brick.
Oh, who would pay the postage for that?
Yeah, but it can have a brickwork background, a graphic brickwork background.
Would be interesting. Yeah, actually, a QSL card is about the same size as a brick, except it's flat, so it could look like a brick.
Yep.
I love it. Great idea, Ed. Somebody's going to have to think of that. Oh, you already did.
Edmund, last thoughts on this one. It's special event station, something you enjoy. So maybe it's going to give you some more operating time.
Yes, and in my little bit of England, right down on the south coast, Germany is the ideal distance away for working stations on 40 metres. So I suppose this means I'm going to have to really brush up on my German now, aren't I? But beyond that, nothing to add, Martin. Thank you.
All right. Well, at least you're going to get some operating out of it, which is a good one. And a very interesting story for those of us who are interested in history. Wouldn't have known that, Ed. Thanks for raising that one with us. Now, next news story. Dan, you published this on your blog and you found it, but there's been a survey or a group say that HF radio market size is expected to reach $3 billion by 2030. That's, phenomenal, I was thought, you know, all these radios. Now, all right, it isn't going to be amateur, but that's still a big market, isn't it, Dan?
Right. So I ran across this press release from a company called Industry ARC, and they're a marketing research firm. And these companies are in the business of publishing reports, which they sell to manufacturers of different types of equipment, and in this case, HF radio equipment, about what they see as the markets in the years ahead. And in this case, their report is saying that the HF radio market is predicted to reach $3 billion by 2030. And I thought this might be of interest to folks because, you know, we often talk about the size of the amateur radio market. And this encompasses much more than just amateur radio. And in fact, unfortunately, I wasn't able to find any information about what slice of the HF radio market amateur radio equipment occupies. But I thought it was kind of interesting because like I say, they're predicting it to reach $3 billion by 2030, and that's a growth rate of 5.1% during the period between 2023 and 2030. So that's, not insubstantial, you know, and think that it would sort of predict that there'll be, you know, because the market's growing, there'll be investment in it, and therefore, we should see some developments, even though amateur radio is maybe a big slice of that. It still predict that we'll see some invest. You know, the manufacturers will invest in it, and we'll see cooler radios in the future. That's the pretext anyway.
Well, that's good. And if there's that kind of investment, or they're expecting the market to be that big, then, you know, some really cool new radios are probably on their way to us. Well, there's been some interesting ones in the last few years, but that should be even bigger.
Right. And so I'm going to actually, I just ran across this today, in fact. And so what I'm going to try and do is contact this company and see if they can't give me a little bit more information, maybe about the amateur radio market, because I think that would be an interesting thing for my readers and for our listeners.
Yeah. Well, I know we did one a few months back, within the last year anyway, of ICOM's marketing predictions. And amateur radio wasn't a big number. It was somewhere between 10 and 15% of their whole revenue comes from amateur radio. So, you know, there are a lot of other people using HF out there, but it's still a big number, which is good.
Well, right. And, you know, if it was, let's say amateur radio was 10% of the HF radio market, wow, that's still $300 million, right? So that's, you know, that's not chump change.
Oh, yes, that'll be a good one. Ed, what's your thoughts?
Well, this story obviously is related to the US. Dan, is this worldwide?
No, I think it's supposed to be worldwide.
Okay. All right, then other countries do have HF radio, as in a commercial service, so to say. For example, in Australia, there's HF radio for people for businesses, travel across the country. And quite simply, you can't get the range. You don't have cell phone coverage. You can't get the range with normal mobile commercial radios on VHF. And so there is actually a HF network, as well as the amateur radio, of course. But that could be part of the marketplace as well. And I would expect places like Africa, as they say, HF is still the go-to for long-range communications. And, you know, that can be on land, it can be on sea, it can be in the air. So there's actually quite a lot of HF communications, as in person-to-base or person-to-person, around that we sometimes don't think of. And so, well, it's still $3 billion is still a lot of money by 2030. So we will only gain from it in the amateur radio side because, of course, if more and more HF radios are being built, the technology will advance and also the parts for them will be available. Hence, for a company like ICOM or Yaesu or Kenwood or Elecraft or Flex to come along and build a new model HF radio, they can have the electronics. They'll have access to the electronics that's used in the commercial HF gear. So, you know, that it's all good news. We on this podcast often say, don't forget the shortwaves. You know, they aren't dead. They aren't gone. Yes, some countries have closed down their shortwave stations, but the advantage of that is the ones further away you can now hear. So, obviously, on a communications point, and also military have repeatedly said they need to keep HF communications because they can't always rely on satellites. So, yeah, all good. So if you can get a better split down from industry ARC, Dan, that would obviously be of interest to everybody. But it's generally good news, I think.
Certainly is. Edmund, does this mean you and I have got to buy new radios? Hi.
Well, I already own more gear than I use regularly anyway, but having said that, there are some nice new models coming out, so maybe this is a line I could try using on my other half to see what happens. So, yeah, I'm sure I'll buy a new radio eventually, Martin.
Yeah, I'm sure we all will, mate. Don't you worry about that. Karen, what's your thoughts?
Okay, Ed, you stole my thunder here. I was going to say there is a real awakening, at least here in the U.S. military, that HF radio is an important alternative to SATCOM. I think more and more they're recognizing SATCOM may not always be viable if for instance, you're in the jungle or you're in a polar region, you don't have line of sight. SATCOM also kicks the budget up quite a few notches in terms of cost and might be impractical if the SATCOM equipment is simply too large. HF can be a surface wave. It can follow the curve of the Earth and definitely beyond line of sight. So I would be curious to know how much of this is being driven by military committing themselves to more and more HF. Obviously, I would be more delighted to know this is all being driven by amateur radio, but let's be realistic. It, as long as it's growing, as long as HF is in use, I think the market will continue to be in good shape. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I think you're right, Karen. It's an interesting one. And, you know, HF, well, we talk about HF, and you've talked, both you and Ed have talked about the military. MVIS is one of those systems where you can get a range of about 600 miles, say, of MVIS. It's not going to go across the pond. It's not this, that, and the other. But it goes down into valleys. And from a military point of view, that might be more than enough 600-mile radius to for what you're doing. And it's a cheap option so compared with satellites. So, you know, I can't see why they wouldn't use it. There you go on that one. Okay, next news story. Is Logbook of the World killing the QSL card? You know, well, I'm not a big QSL card person. I've actually admitted this, so, you know, you have to beat me up a little bit about this one. Edmund, you reckon you get lots of QSL cards, but has yours dropped off?
Well, I wouldn't say I get lots, and I wouldn't say I've ever got lots, but then I'm not as active on the air as many other people out there. The thing with QSL cards was when I was studying for my foundation license in 2009, that was when I discovered what QSL cards were, and I decided with absolute certainty right at the outset that I had no interest at all in QSL cards. I don't know how or why I came to that opinion, but I was absolutely adamant, and I worked a station not long after I was licensed in Northern Ireland, and a week or two later an envelope landed on my doormat and he had sent me a QSL card directly, and it wasn't a particularly snazzy card at all. It was quite sort of basic and simple what was written on the front of it, but on the back of it he had written a personalized message. It was only about two sentences long. It didn't cover the entire of the back of the card or anything. But the fact that this person had taken the time and trouble and effort to write something on the back of the card, it made me feel like that QSO had actually meant something to him. And instantly, my whole attitude to QSL cards completely changed. And overnight, I went from having nothing to do with it to sending envelopes to the bureau and getting some cards printed. And based on the experience of this chap, my QSL card has a photograph and space where you can write details of the QSO on the front, but the back of it is intentionally blank so that I can write as much or as little as I want, but I can write a personal message in English or in a foreign language if I want to give somebody a good laugh at how terrible my written German is, for example. And I'm not against electronic QSLing. I am signed up to EQSL and maybe one or two others, but any person can press a button on a keyboard. It's minimal effort. It's possibly even automatic in some cases. Anybody could do it. You know, I could manage that. But taking the time and trouble to pick up a pen and actually write something, that to me intrinsically has value. And I look at my paper QSL cards sometimes. I've got 3 or 4 photograph albums that contain cards going back over the last decade. And I enjoy flicking through them in the evenings and at weekends. In my job, I spend an awful lot of hours every week looking at a computer screen. When I'm not at work in the evenings and at the weekends, I don't necessarily want to look at a computer screen for even more hours than I do connected to my employment. So having something in paper that I can physically hold and look at, I like it. In the same way that some people like having physical paper copies of magazines rather than electronic versions, and in the same way that some people, me included, enjoy holding a 12-inch LP vinyl rather than having a file, an electronic file on my MP3 player. So I know it's more of a minority sport these days than it was in years and decades gone by, but I think it's still valuable, and it serves as happy reminders of QSOs from years ago. And some of the cards are written by people who are now no longer with us, sadly. So it's a nice reminder of friends who've shuffled off this mortal coil. And I don't think paper QSL cards will ever die altogether. Yes, there may be a decline, but they'll still be going for a good few years yet, I hope. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I knew you enjoyed QSL cards. That's a good one. Now, when we started talking about this before we recorded, Karen, you said you're a big fan of QSL cards, aren't you?
I love QSL cards. I love what they mean. I love what they do. I also love that they're old school, and anything having to do with amateur radio, of course, is a nod to history, and some of that history is in QSL cards. People love them so much, they buy them and sell them on eBay. People like to collect them. What I love isn't just the card. I love what the card says. I love the images on the card. I love a chance to see a picture of who I spoke with, or a picture of something they love, or a picture of their station, or something meaningful for them. Sometimes the cards arrive as postcards, but oftentimes they are now well protected inside an envelope so that they arrive in somewhat pristine condition. And little gifts from my DX contacts can include a sample coin, a sample piece of paper money. Not that I'm looking to get rich from this, you understand. This is a gesture of friendship. One ham in the last month sent me a beautiful scarf from France celebrating the World Cup. I mean, this is a gift between friends. That's why we do this. Do I have EQSL? Yes, I do. I went kicking and screaming into using that website. I'm not thrilled with it, but it is proof that I had a contact, and I acknowledge and appreciate that not everybody has my enthusiasm. So I respect people for that. But bring on the QSL cards. I'd rather get them in the mail than a utility bill. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, well, we always refer to the real mail, the post mail in this house, as hate mail. So when I see the postman arriving, it's like, hate mail's arrived. And it's always a nice surprise when you get something from amateur radio within amongst it. But on that one. Dan, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, I'm with Karen and Ed. I love to get QSL cards, and I enjoy sending them out. So I think maybe what Logbook of the World has done is reduce the amount of it certainly has reduced the amount of cards because, you know, you don't no longer have to swap QSL cards to get, they don't count for DXCC that much anymore, or worked all states or whatever the various awards are. But maybe that's a good thing because now they're used, as Karen and Ed do, Edmund do, for, you know, making personal contact. And that's how I do it. I get probably two or three every week, and I always reply. And if I haven't replied to anybody that's listening, please email me and I'll send you one if I manage somehow to miss yours. But I also send them out. And for example, I'm off at the net control station for our local club 2-meter net. And if someone logs into or checks into the net that whose call is obviously a new call or someone I haven't heard before, I'll send them my QSL card, you know, even for just a 2-meter FM contact over the repeater, because A, I wanted to encourage them to join our club and become active in our club. And B, I always love being the first QSL card that someone receives. So like, especially like people in my class, if I hear them, you know, finally check into our net, I get that QSL card to them right away because I want to be the first to send them a QSL card. So yeah, you know, Logbook of the World is, to get back to the question, Logbook of the World may be killing the amount of QSL cards, but the QSL cards that are being sent now maybe have more meaning.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the three of you enjoy QSL cards. Ed, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, those who read the show notes will see this actual whole topic started through a post that was on Dan's blog site, where he had received a lot of vintage QSL cards. And that struck a note with me, which is why I raised this for us all to discuss. QSL cards used to be a lot more important than they are now, it seems. QSL cards were previously used, as Dan touched on, to confirm things like awards, such as VKCC, whatever, DXCC, sorry. And also contest scoring, even in the earlier days. Now, that has almost completely gone now. It's all done through online logs and scoring and cross-checking between logs, which is inevitable because of one of the problems of sending cards. If you send them direct through the post, they're going to take a time to get wherever they're going, if they even arrive. If you send them via a bureau, a national bureau, that will also take a lot longer. And as the volume of QSL cards is dropping, there are actually QSL bureaus closing. Some countries' QSL bureaus, in the last year, I believe it's either two or three different countries, no longer have QSL bureaus because simply wasn't worth running anymore because the volume had dropped so much. And that's one downside. The positive upside of physically getting a card in the post is what the others have said as well. It's lovely to see the pictures. It's lovely to make that personal contact. It's lovely that somebody takes the time to write some more comments on the card, be they typed on or handwritten. I think we're in the middle of a change, though. There are now, starting up over the last few months, or 6 months to a year, three or four different QSL systems, and what they actually do on the internet is you can go into these systems, you can create your own graphics, you can put your own text on the cards, and then these systems will send them out via email to the contact, who can then physically print it to a 6x4 photo paper card. So they still get the actual paper card, but then they're getting that within days or weeks of a contact, not years, which is what happens sometimes. Is that the same? No, it's not handwritten, but it's probably about as close as we're going to get. When I lived in Australia, every single QSL card that I sent out was handmade by me, and every single one was different. I did things like if I was sending out cards from a SOTA activation, I would use a picture that I had taken from the summit and put my own comments on, etc. So customizing and using computers to create unique individual cards is a plus point. Whether they will ever be as good as the vintage cards that Dan received, I doubt it. But we're in a time of change. It'd be interesting if the listeners want to make comments on icqpodcast.com, please do so. What your opinion is about QSL cards. Some of us use them a lot. Some of us only use a few. To some of us, they're more important than others. As we often say on this podcast, everybody's different. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, we certainly are, mate. And I'm not a big QSL card person, so I'm probably the odd one out on this group. But it's horses for courses, and if you enjoy them, carry on using them. That's what I would suggest here. Right, move to our last news story. It's about, once again, about satellites, but FCC sets rules for cellular satellite coverage. Karen, you put this in, so would you like to go first on it?
Yes, thank you, Martin. This is an interesting development because already some cellular phones are already making use of the satellites in an emergency when there is no terrestrial coverage. So basically, the FCC is letting people catch up and letting the major manufacturers catch up. Now there are rules and guidelines for this, and this is expected to accelerate the use and the availability. So that is certainly helpful. The industry is calling it a supplemental coverage from space, SCS. Now, when I first heard about this, my original thought was, oh my gosh, well, if somebody's in an area and they get into trouble, a stranded motorist in a remote part, say, of the United States, and they had an auto accident. And we've run stories about this. And along comes a ham radio operator who happens to have an HT, as many do, in the car, and it's programmed for the local repeaters or perhaps for simplex, or they have even an HF radio in the car. They can summon help. And now, you know, the thought being, well, gee, somebody can do this themselves with their own cell phone. But that also presumes that there is line of sight available and that they can have satellite service. So what is the potential impact for amateur radio? I don't know. Probably not a lot. What is the potential for public safety? Probably greater. So this is definitely a good thing. These rules were needed. It was otherwise either not going to go forward or it would have been kind of like the Wild West. So good for the FCC for getting this done. Let's see how the market responds. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, you raised some interesting points there, in fairness. Dan, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, I don't really have too much to say either, except that, it'll be good for folks that find themselves without coverage and are in need of assistance. I just would hope that the supplemental coverage doesn't become sort of the primary coverage and all of a sudden we got, 10,000 more satellites up there.
Yeah, I know what you mean. We don't want any more space junk. Ed, last words on this one?
Yeah, I'll just echo. I was about to say the same thing that Dan just said. If this becomes effective over the whole of the US and maybe the whole of the world, then why do you need the expense of the cell towers? Why not just run everything off the satellites? So, yeah, as we say, problem there will be more and more space junk. Mind you, I guess to start with, they'll be charging you an arm and a leg to use this new service. It will be something that's as cheap as the normal service, I would expect, but maybe I'm wrong. And yeah, so as long as there's some good regulation in place to protect security and protect systems being hacked, etc., from a point of view of emergency phone coverage, plus for a point of view of day-to-day usage, minus. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, at least the FCC are ahead and they've put some rules in place, so hopefully it won't be a free-for-all when the technology catches up totally. So, yeah, good one. Right, let's find out what the guys have been up to since the last time we spoke. And we always go ladies first on this section, don't we, Karen?
Yes, we do, and I always respond with POTA. I am very, very eager to stop doing car POTA and get out and sit on a bench somewhere and set my antenna up out in the park and be in the park rather than looking at the park through my sunroof. So we're still making that attempt. I did try this past Sunday. That was a bit of a disaster because I did not think I needed to anchor my tripod. And you can imagine what happened when a gust of wind came along. So the FCC would not have approved of my verbal response to that, but I took the antenna apart and went back to doing car POTA. So I have nothing exciting to report. Oh, I do actually, yes. I'm sorry. I do have a special event station that I'm going to be operating as starting next week. It's World Awareness for Autism. This is a very, very important event. And I will be among many operators around the world who will be getting on the air. World Awareness for Autism will be directing people to understand what autism is, that it affects everybody. Everybody knows somebody who's either impacted by it or on the spectrum. And it's to educate. It's going to be in connection with World Autism Awareness Day, and that is on April 2nd. People in other countries will be operating as well. It's a worthwhile event. And you know me, I love my special event stations. And when they are combined with a good cause, it's even better. That's it for me. Hopefully next time you ask me what I'm up to, I will tell you I operated outdoors in a park and my antenna remained upright. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, no problems at all. Well, while you were talking about that, I was thinking, and I keep threatening I'm going to go out and do some parks on the air. Probably isn't going to happen until I get back from Dayton, if I'm being brutally honest at the moment. There's a lot of things going on. But I've got a ATAS 15, I think it is, the manual ATAS antenna, which you put on a tripod. And as you were saying, sort of anchoring the tripod, I'm thinking, maybe that's something else I've got to think about. It's just one of the antennas I sometimes use when I go out or in the backyard, as you guys would call it in the States, or back garden over here. It gets used there. So, yeah, a good tip, Karen. Make sure you anchor your tripod. That's a good one. Right, Dan, what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Well, I hate to gloat, but I actually have been outside in a park, sitting at a park bench and operating POTA. Last week, it got up to 70 degrees here, and I couldn't miss that opportunity. So I did, about 35, 36 contacts up at the park I usually go to. Another thing that happened, that's happened since the last episode, is that a fellow sent me an antenna that he put together. And what he had done, basically it's a sort of a homebrew version of the Wolf River Coil antenna. And I haven't actually had a chance to get it outside and get it set up, but it's kind of on my list of things to do. The fellow that sent it to me is Ryan. I'll give him a shout out here. Ryan Alpha Delta Zero Tango Zulu. So thanks, Ryan, for that, and be listening for my progress with that antenna. And then finally, you know, still working on the book. I'm getting closer and closer now, and hopefully I'll have some copies at Dayton to sell. So keeping my fingers crossed on that.
Well, that sounds good. And my only regret on your books, Dan, is I passed all three before I knew they existed. But having seen them after I passed my exam, they would have made it a lot easier. And your books are pretty damn good, in my opinion, Dan. And not just because I know you, but they are well worth a look if anybody's studying. Right. Edmund, what have you been up to? And I know you've been operating today, so don't say nothing.
Well, I'd done precious little transmitting this year until today, and we're recording this on Wednesday, the 20th of March, so the day of the spring equinox. I went to Amberley Museum, mainly for a health and safety training course that lasted all of 1 hour, so that left a little bit of time to play amateur radio. And 40 meters is usually the band of choice, but 10 meters was open. I'm sure it's open on many other days as well, but I'm not normally listening to it at home. And conditions were good. America and Canada started coming in weekly and with fading between about 12 and 1 o'clock local time. But the following hour, the signals really, really came up. So if you're going to go on 10 meters from the UK or Europe in the next few days or couple of weeks, early afternoon would be a good time to try and work the US. And we even had one person who called us using 5 watts, and he was very weak, but we worked him, an American station, can't remember the call sign. He then went up to 50 watts, and whilst I'm not normally a big advocate of increasing power, going from 5 watts to 50 watts in marginal conditions did make all the difference. So that was really nice. Coming up on the day the podcast is released, this Sunday, I hope to be going down to Dover in Kent with Martin to attend the Dover rally down there. And the only other thing I can think of off the top of my head, at the end of March, on the Saturday during the Easter weekend, so Saturday the 30th, between midday and 3 p.m. local time, approximately, there is a very informal event taking place on the 70 centimeter band. In previous editions of the podcast, you might have heard us talk about 145 Alive, which is aimed at promoting FM simplex activity on 2 meters. Well, there is also a thing called 433 Alive, which aims to do the same thing on 70 centimeters. There is a Facebook group, and the suggestion is that on the dates and times that I mentioned, people go on the band, maybe go portable from high ground, call CQ on 433.500, which is the FM calling channel. Certainly in the UK, if not in Europe as well, and just try to work people. 145 Alive has net controllers on high grounds and people get passed round. For 433, there's nothing like that. It's just I was going to say free for all. That's probably not a good description, but it's do your own thing and try and work as many people as possible. It's not a contest. It's just to have QSOs for the sake of it, a kind of operation. So I'm going to take part. I'm going to try to get from high ground, assuming that the weather isn't absolutely terrible. And of course, at those frequencies, you can get useful gain from relatively small antennas. So I'll be taking my little 70 centimeter Yagi with me. on Saturday the 30th of March. That's everything, I think. Martin, back to you.
Right. Well, I didn't know about 433 Alive. I knew about 145 Alive. The boys at the club are doing that one. So 433 Alive, maybe we'll talk about it. Maybe I'll come down and come out with you on that one. That'll be a bit of fun. But, yeah, sounds interesting, Edmund. Ed, what have you been up to?
Well, it seems that to be in this group, everybody has to talk about Porter. I'll certainly be at a Porter Park in April because we're doing a short getaway, the family. And the place we're staying is actually in the middle of a park, a Porter Park, so I'll be on then. But the main actions there will be up to Sota and Hema summits, of course. The other thing that I and it seemed to always start these, what you've been doing is antenna related. And of course, I've made some more advancements to the portable HF wire beam. They're all documented up on my blog at dd5lp.com. But of more interest to the listeners will be ICQ Live, which with the others I'm organising, and it will take place via the ICQ Digital Bridge. On Saturday, April the 13th, 2024, from 1900 to 2100 UTC. And this is an event that lets you, our listeners, actually take part in the show, giving us your opinions, your comments, your news about your projects, which will then become part of a feature. So you'll hear more about ICQ Live on the next show. But of course, full details are also on the icqpodcast.com website. So if you can get on to the ICQ Digital Bridge, be it via radio, hotspot, or via one of the apps, all the details are on the website. Come and join us on Saturday, April the 13th. And so you can actually talk with some of the presenters and let us know what you think. That's about it for now, Martin. Back to you.
Yeah, no problems at all, Ed. Well, you call it a bridge, I call it a talk group, but we're both right. So whichever way you want to join up, it's the ICQ Digital Network, effectively, where we've got joints to most of the leading digital voice systems. So you can find out on the ICQ website more as well. So, yeah, forgot we're doing that one. Colin's about to put that one in for you. No problems at all. What have I been doing? Well, very quickly, God forbid, don't fall off your chairs, boys. I have done a little bit of HF. I've had only a few contacts. I'm not a big operator. I like to fiddle and play with things, electronics more than anything else. But, I've been doing a little bit of HF operating and had quite a bit of fun on that. Did a smart radio a couple of weeks ago, and we'll do another one this Saturday. Say, just promoting what we do to the hobby. Colin managed to get a 2-page article into Radcom about how the problems we're having with our hobby of getting people into the hobby. It's called Amateur Radio, Somebody Else's Problem. And it highlights it's not only an amateur radio problem. The problem is it's a societal problem. But we'll look forward to any feedback on that one. I've been operating mobile a reasonable amount because I've been out in the car quite a bit recently. And I've also been on the talk group not as many times as I'd like. On the Sunday morning this releases, Edmund and I will be terrorising the people in Dover because we'll be at the Dover Rally. Looking forward to that one. And if you're here early and you're going to the Dover Rally, come and join us, come say hi. We'll look forward to that. And, yeah, all noted about 433 Alive. Maybe I'll come and help you, Edmund. I'm going to check my diary and we'll talk later. So that's what I've been up to. So all that's left for me to do now is to thank the guys for coming along tonight and being with me to talk to the to promote these news stories. I'd like to thank Mr. Dan Romacek, KB6NU. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I'd like to thank Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT.
Always great to be a part of the team. Thank you, Martin.
Yeah, we're one big family here, Karen. And once you're in, you can't get out, I'm afraid. Hi, hi. I'd like to thank Mr. Edmund Spicer, M0MMG.
Thanks for having me on, Martin.
No problems. And I'd like to thank Mr. Ed Durant, DD5LP.
Thanks a lot, Martin, and cheers to everybody.
Yeah. So 73, guys, and we'll move on to the next part of the contest. 73.
73.
Keep your amateur ham radio podcast advert-free by donating less than a length of coax. Visit www.icqpodcast.com/donate now. For all the news, links and information, visit www.icqpodcast.com.
And now it's time to have a look at the news in brief for me, Colin M6BRY. We start with news here in Germany, where the regulator has announced that the call sign designation for new entry-level N-class licensees will be taking effect on the 21st of June, and that prefix will be DN9, the Delta November 9, which adds a numeral to the previously announced DN prefix. It's expected to have a capacity of more than 1,800 call sign assignments available. The first examinations of the N-class licenses will take place on the weekend of the 28th of June at Ham Radio Friedrichshafen. The license conforms to the SEPTA requirements for an entry-level license. So, say news there, if you start to hear DN9 prefix call signs on the air from Germany, there'll be new novice class licenses, as I say, to help those guys along the way with their radio journey. Talking about events coming up, Dayton Hamvention is less than 2 months away, and the board have announced this year's winners of their awards. The Technical Achievement Award goes to Ward Silver, November Zero Alpha X-Ray. The Club of the Year Award goes to the Young Ladies Radio League. The Amateur of the Year Award goes to Edward Engelman, KG8 Charlie X-Ray. And say congratulations to all who won the awards. Information about each award, etc., will be on the ICQ Podcast webpage, icqpodcast.com. And news that are coming up later on this year, on April the 27th, is International Marconi Day, where, of course, we give thanks to the Italian inventor and electrical engineer who invented radio telegraphic systems and creating Marconi's Law. Now, to honour this, the Cornish Radio Amateur Radio Club, GX4 Charlie Romeo Charlie, will be hosting their annual event. Purpose of the day is for radio enthusiasts around the world to contact the historic Marconi sites using a combination of techniques similar to those that would have been used at the time. So lots of information available on this one for you. We've got links to the Facebook page, etc., for you, and the registration page, so you can take part on Marconi Day. Right, then we head to our features episode, where we learn all about the HamSci Eclipse events. As always, hope you enjoy.
And now, what you've all been waiting for, this episode's feature from the ICQ podcast. Well, hi guys. I've been lucky enough to talk to Gary, F8A, who's a member of the HamSci team, and Gary's going to tell us more about what's going on. This month there is a, as I understand it, an event conference, followed by, in April, you've got a full eclipse of the sun, and it's been interesting. We've been following this from the podcast point of view for quite a while. So it's great to get somebody from the group to come and talk to us. So, Gary, short history about yourself, and then we'll go for it.
Very well, Martin. Thank you. I've been a ham now for close to 50 years. It's hard to believe. I started like a lot of us did when I was a teenager, finishing up school. I enjoyed here in the States, of course, you start with the novice exam, and I worked my way through the various licenses. I ended up with my extra back in 1978, and that's when I obtained this call sign. I was very fortunate. I took a great deal of interest in electronics and engineering, and then went to a university here in Cleveland at a place called Case Western Reserve, where I earned a degree in electrical engineering. I was very fortunate to work for a local company building industrial electronics. Actually, it was Arc Welding Equipment. I worked for them for 34 years and retired about 6 years ago. So now I can honestly say that I am a retired engineer and a full-time ham.
Oh, that sounds great to me, as I say. I think I've retired now. I say think I've retired. If a job offer went on the table tomorrow, I'd probably take it. But yeah, I'm well past retiring age in the UK anyway. But as I say, sounds like you had a very, very interesting career and ham for 50 years. That's great. And you say you obviously enjoy the hobby. So, as part of Hamsai, what's your kind of involvement with Hamsai?
Sure. Just to recap real briefly, the title of our organization, Hamsai, is the Ham Radio Science Citizen Investigation. And our group consists of kind of two groups working together. Part of it are mostly ham radio operators and also what we call citizen scientists. Most, like me, have no formal training in the sciences, but we do have an interest in things like radio wave propagation, the ionosphere, and so on. And the other part of our organization are the professional researchers, university professors, and that sort of thing. So I've been involved with HAMSI on and off since 2019, when I first attended their workshop also here in Cleveland. About a year and a half ago, I saw and participating in a number of Zoom calls and conversations with others in HAMSI, I could see there was a need for, I guess you'd call it a project manager role to help shepherd some of these projects along, things like our solar eclipse QSO party or the deployment of the GRAPE Doppler receivers. So I volunteered my services, and lo and behold, I actually have a title. Technically, I'm the HAMSI Amateur Radio Community Coordinator. So I do a little bit of everything, except the deep dive into science. I guess that's how I put it.
Well, that sounds great. And somebody who has the ability to project manage or drive things forward, that must be a really big advantage to HAMSI, because sometimes people just need to be not given roles to do. Some people can't, well, very capable of what they do, but they can't focus. So being a project manager, you must oversee a lot of things and oversee the overall project.
Well, I take a lot of pride in being able to, I guess the word I would use is translate from what the scientists and the science community needs. Back to what the amateur radio community can contribute. In fact, my job, when I was working for many years, I used to do systems design, computer systems design. So I was taking specifications of, okay, this is what we want the system to accomplish, take it to the technical folks who would program it and build it. I would then help test, help document, and roll it out. So in some small portion, I guess you could say, in some days I'm a teacher. Some days I'm a cowboy with a bullwhip trying to herd the cattle together and get them all to move in the same direction. But mostly I get to sit back and watch others hopefully be successful at what they're doing, and we'll meet our goals.
Well, that sounds great. And it sounds like you've got it under control. Now, I think this is interesting, because I always find with amateur radio, if you've got something to do or if you get involved with something, it nearly always happens. If you just say, oh, I think next Saturday I'll operate, there's a fairly high chance you won't. But I think this is nice, because it's involving people, doing some work, and working as a team.
That's very true. I mean, the organization definitely has goals. I mean, obviously, like any other project, there are short-term goals and long-term ones. And it is satisfying to see us reach some of those short-term milestones. You know, sometimes we fail or we get off track, but to try to steer ourselves back in the right direction and have some achievements that we can crow about, that is a good thing.
Certainly. Now, as I say, it must be interesting to see the data come in, because I know when you asked the ham community to take some measurements, you don't know what you're going to get. And it must be interesting seeing that data come in and go, yeah, that's fine. But this is something I'm asking because I don't know the answer myself is, do you sort of look at it and go, well, these 90% of it say this, so that's it, but the odd one that's way off, up or down, must be a mistake? I suppose there must be some checking of the data.
Well, there certainly is. And it's funny you ask me that question now because I'm in the middle of working on trying to finalize the scores from our solar eclipse QSO party. And I can see that there are some operators who are very good. They make a lot of contacts. The logs we receive from them are complete. They're accurate, have signal reports and grid squares and whatnot. And every once in a while, you get a log submitted that'll be missing some very critical information. And you can go back and ask the individual to supply it. Sometimes they're unable. It's something that happened in the past. So they go in what we call the check log pile. So as far as amateur radio data, I'm pretty familiar with that, and I can look at that. When it comes to the more in-depth science-type data, we've got more professionals that do that. In fact, we've got a young woman who's working on her doctorate degree at Case Western Reserve, and she'll be helping us analyze the eclipse data as it comes in. So there's others who are far more skilled at that than I am, but I do get to listen in on some of their grumblings, and you are correct. Good part of the data analysis is knowing how to filter it, what to cast aside, and what to keep. You're very correct.
Well, as I say, I'm just thinking, because as while we're sitting here chatting, you know, if you're getting hundreds of logs come in, it must be very, very interesting to see. And one of the things I like about this project is that you guys are actually publicising it and the data. It's not a one-way valve. It what's coming in will eventually come back to amateur radio for amateur radio people to see the results.
I think there's a couple of good points you've made there. One is to see the results. It takes, as I've learned, a few years because the scientific process involves a lot of generating theories, checking on those theories, submitting the theories and the data to organizations for peer review, and there's a lot of back and forth. So that sometimes takes a long time. But once we get there, the hope is exactly as you say, that amateur radio will have given a lot to HAMSI and the research end of things. We want HAMSI to be able to give back to the amateur community. And one of the areas we're hoping to see that it is in the scientific model, say, of the ionosphere, how well it works, how well it supports propagation at different times of the day, different seasons, different flux levels. I mean, today we can go to various websites and do propagation forecasts, and they're reasonably accurate, but we could do a lot better. And hopefully through the activities of HAMSI over the next, 1 to 5 years, we can feed that back to the very, very clever people who create and maintain those models and improve them. So someday you and I will be able to go to the same website. We'll plug in our call signs, the solar flux data and that sort of thing, and it'll tell us whether or not we'll be able to have a QSO on 20 meters tomorrow. We're not really there yet, but the hope is maybe someday.
Yeah, well, that certainly sounds interesting. And I enjoy the fact that sometimes the uncertainty, but then there's other times when you just want to operate, or you want to talk to your colleague, in another country, which is good news. Now, you guys have already had one conference. I believe you've got a conference at the end of the month coming up where you're going to discuss lots of things. Do you want to tell us about that one?
Sure. HAMSI has what we call a workshop once a year. And this is run in a very similar fashion to a true scientific workshop. The difference I have to be clear about is many of the papers and ideas presented here have not yet gone through the peer review process. We're mostly just putting ideas out there for discussion, and hopefully that fertile minds will adopt some of these ideas and be able to run with them. But the workshop is a two-day event. The first day or day and a half is primarily presentations. We have oral sessions where, in most cases, the presenters will be here in Cleveland on the Case Western campus. And those oral sessions have various topics. One is on our personal space weather station. So there'll be talk about data, about construction, circuit design, and so forth. The second session will be more about propagation, how the WWV signals that we've been monitoring, that's a time and frequency station on the other side of the U.S., how that project's been going along, how beacons and flares and things interact with one another. The third session will also be talking about some of the projects that we're doing here related with the eclipse. And we've got a few extra things thrown in. We've got some, we always try to have some students by whether they're anywhere from 16 to 22 or 25 years old presenting. So they get a feel how science works. And then on Saturday, typically what we have are called poster sessions, where people don't give up and give a full 15 or 20 minute talks. They describe or illustrate their ideas on these posters, which are about a meter squared. And they will stand in front of their posters in a large hall, and then the other attendees can circulate and ask them questions. So there's a variety of formats we use, and hopefully it keeps everything interested and everyone moving.
Well, that sounds great. And the only shame for me is that I live in the UK and couldn't attend this event. I know in the past a couple of the ICQ presenters have attended your event, and they found it thoroughly enjoyable. One of the things, unfortunately, because we're an audio podcast, they can't see the gorgeous set of slides you sent me to show me what you're doing. I mean, the presentation slides you sent me are really, really interesting. And, you know, if people go along to the workshop, surely they will see some of these.
Well, the good thing is for you and for your other listeners, there is a virtual option to attend the workshop. There is no cost. Folks can go to our website, hamsci.org, and right near the front page, there'll be some quick links, which will take you to the HamSci workshop page. There's a button for registering for either in-person or virtual attendance. So even with or without the time difference, if you want to check in and at various times of the day and maybe you see which programs you'd like to attend. We also have the complete agenda up there, so you can see not only who's going to be presenting, but what they'll be presenting. And you can actually read their abstracts to get a little bit of an in-depth view.
All right. So that to me, and I've been a naughty boy because I should have spent more time on your website, but that is really good that you're offering the virtual connection, which means that it's not only people in the States who can attend this. And I'm sure when we've had eclipses, you know, you must also be interested in data coming in from other places that may be on the fringe of the eclipse.
That's true. We have done studies not only of North American eclipses. There's a researcher, her name is Christina Collins. She actually earned her PhD partially by working with HamSci on various eclipse projects. And she's had people gathering data and being involved in Asia, Australia, and even the Antarctic continent. So there's we cover quite a bit of territory, to be sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I say, it's an interesting thing to do. And I'm certainly going to see if I can attend some of your virtual lectures, because it's the sort of thing I think anybody who's a technical person will enjoy. And we ought to try and understand other things in the hobby and what else is going on. Our hobby is massive. Propagation is something that, you know, I've said to new students or members of the public, you could probably talk to somebody for the best part of a week and you still wouldn't know it all. There's a lot going on in propagation.
Well, the thing to remember, too, is as we've talked about, there's definitely an impact, as we know, on the amateur radio community, the study of propagation. But there are many other users of radio services which either pass through or make direct use of the ionosphere. For instance, our friend Elon Musk, all his Starlink satellites are in low Earth orbit, and their signals at very high frequencies, in the microwave bands, of course, but they are passing through the ionosphere. I know the military here in the States, and I'm sure in many other countries, might not admit it, but they are still using shortwave bands. Some of the high-tech stuff they use is all well and fine, but if a satellite has a problem, There's nothing wrong with pulling out the field radio, extending the whip, and communicating on single sideband, for instance. Maybe scrambled, but we just have to remember there's a lot of users out there, and that's one of the reasons we're funded by places like here in the States, the National Science Foundation, or even NASA, the Space Administration, does provide us some funding too.
Yeah, well, that's good. And you mentioned the military. I mean, in fairness, NVIS, Near Vertical Skywave, that to me was something that the military were using. And I think us amateurs stumbled across it later. Whereas what they are not necessarily looking for, the massive distance contact, they're looking to get into valleys and, you know, close-up stuff and cover an area for communications. So even things like that are going to help.
Yeah, that's right. I do a little bit of work with our local amateur radio emergency service, and we try to have at least a once a year an exercise where we pull out the gear, try to experiment with some very low or very unusually designed antennas just for NVIS purposes.
Well, let's just say that sounds great. Now, you've got the event happening in April. Do you have any feelings on what might happen at the full eclipse, from a data point of view, or how long is the eclipse going to last for?
Well, the good thing about the eclipse this year, this is actually the third time we'll be studying the band during a full eclipse. The first time was in 2017. It was publicized, but not nearly as well. The results have been in a few magazines and things, and CQ and QST and whatnot. But so we had some experience from 2017. For instance, I think many hams are familiar with what we call gray line propagation, how the bands will change near sunrise or sunset as the ionosphere above us is in that transition period between either darkness and full light or vice versa. The hypothesis in 2017 was, well, when the eclipse goes overhead, when the moon between the sun and the earth and shades the ionosphere, we should see something similar to gray line conditions. And I don't know if we proved gray line conclusively or not, but in the data, we could definitely see that, for instance, 20 meters here in the States, the average QSO distance that was going on before the eclipse was, say, maybe 1,500 kilometers. As the eclipse was going over the center of the United States, those average distances dropped by about 50 to 60%. So maybe there's a 300 to 400 kilometer range. And within 20 minutes after the eclipse had passed, 20 meters got, as we say, long again. On the flip side of that, if you look at like 40 meters, it actually got longer. The QSO's distance increased as the eclipse went overhead. And no surprise, even 160 meters, the gentleman's band. Of course, there was no activity on it at the beginning or just before the eclipse, because here in the States in 2017, that was in the middle of the day in an August afternoon. Who would be on 160 meters? We wouldn't hear one another. But we can look at the data. We can see that 160 meters actually came to life only a few minutes before the eclipse. And then the signals disappeared a few minutes after. Now, a lot of that has to do with, of course, where the station is situated versus where the eclipse path is. And where I'm living here in Cleveland, Ohio, we're very fortunate. We're going to be directly in the path of the April eclipse. So we'll be in totality for maybe 4 to 4.5 minutes. Now, that sounds like a very short time from a ham radio and research perspective. But you have to keep in mind that eclipse for us in the States is starting way in the southwest part of the country near Texas. And it's cutting across the whole country diagonally to the northeast and eventually exiting off the Canadian maritime provinces. So it takes about 3 hours for that eclipse to transit the whole country. So the experiment, though, locally, we may only feel like we're being impacted by the eclipse for a matter of minutes. But from a radio perspective, from the ionosphere's perspective, you know, 400 to 500 kilometers above our head, it's a much longer event. And that just gives us more time to collect valuable data.
Well, that's certainly an interesting point I hadn't thought about. But, yeah, the amount of time. Now, Gary, is there anything I've missed that you guys are doing?
So we definitely have the operating events, the Solar Eclipse QSO party, that's get on the air and make contact, whether it's FT8 or CW or sideband. We've added something new this year called the Gladstone Signal Spotting Challenge. Many of your listeners are probably familiar with what's called the Whisper Mode, WSPR, Weak Signal Propagation Reporter. And we've actually created a competitive event for folks who might want to either transmit or set up whisper receiving stations. We've also got an experiment where folks that like to build things and like to tinker, you can look at our website and look into the personal space weather station. One of the options is building a tiny receiver PC board about 2 by 4 centimeters maybe, and it connects up to a Leo Bodnar GPS unit from there in the UK, and also to a Raspberry Pi. And what that little receiver does, you leave it running 24/7, connect it up to the internet so we can get your data, and it actually monitors a single frequency, say 10 megahertz, and listens for anomalies. It listens basically that tells it the ionosphere when it's rising and falling, or when it's very stirred up and very active, say during periods of high solar activity. So that's really what we're talking about: operating events, some chances to build and to tinker. So we try to have something a little bit for everyone.
That sounds great. Now, just as I'm not going to hold you too long because I know you're off on holiday and I've just caught you for your holiday. But if somebody wanted to check you out even more, I know you've given the website once, but would you like to give it again and ways people can contact HAMSI?
Sure. We'd love people to visit our site, hamsci.org, HAMSCI. .org, and from there the quick links on the front, the news items, there's a lot of in-depth information all the way from very cursory high-level things all the way down into some of the scientific papers and stuff. The presentations and things are there as well.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. Gary, I'd like to thank you very much for this interview. I think it's been more than informative to our listeners, and maybe when you've got some final data from this, maybe come back and talk to us again.
We would be glad to do so, Martin. Thank you very much for having myself and giving HAMSI an opportunity to present.
No problems at all, Gary. Listen, I'll say 73s to you. Thank you very much for the chat, and I'm sure our listeners will be more than interested.
73, I hope to hear you and many others on the air next month.
The ICQ Podcast. Come for a moment, stay for an hour.
Well, everybody, I really hope you enjoyed our features episode there on the HAMSI Eclipse. And as I say, I know that that was an interview you really enjoyed doing there with the guys, and you certainly found it a very interesting one to record.
Certainly did, Colin. I mean, yeah, I learned from it. And unfortunately, you know, the event, the workshop event has happened by the time we release. But there's a lot of interesting things Gary was telling me about. And it was just nice. It felt like we were sitting in armchairs chatting, although we were 3,000 miles apart at least. But, yeah, very interesting what Gary had to tell me. And I hope you all got something interesting from it.
Yeah, so I know there's certainly events, etc., to look forward to over the coming weeks. So hopefully that whet your appetite for that eclipse that's coming up there in the next few weeks. Well, we've got some news coming from the guys from WRTC 2026 as well. They've kept us up to date with what's going on as that event starts to draw a little bit closer.
Certainly does, Colin. I think the key points are that the WRTC 2026, they were pleased to announce the results of the first qualification event, which was a CQ worldwide SSB on the 2023. And they've put the information now up on their website. They've also had data from 11,000 plus entrants. So a lot of data coming in, and these will be updated soon. Shortly afterwards, they're going to then make the point scoring system more clear for you. And the results from the CQWWCW contest have now been processed and are ready to be loaded to the scoreboard soon. So, guys, keep an eye on WRTC 2026 website. The website is www.wrtc2026.org. And from there, you can go from the main menu down to look at all sorts of things. So hopefully that will help you. And good news that the WRTC 2026 is moving along nicely.
And I'd even suggest, even if not a contest, they're worthwhile checking out the website just to see, I suppose, the scale of trying to get that number of data entries and entries, etc., which is going to end up becoming down to, I think, is it 50 teams, they were saying, if I remember rightly, and how that number will, I suppose, crunch down over the period of time. So certainly some work to be done there by the committee to get it down to that final number as they approach 2026.
Certainly is, and I'm sure it won't be me on the committee, on the team, Colin, because I'm not a big HF operator.
I was going to say, if you need a champion of rake shoeing, you'll be there like a flash, but say, probably not good on a contest, Mike, but there you go. All right, well, we're going to thank the very kind people that help us do this show and say produce your ICQ podcast for you, and we're going to start off with our very kind donors this episode. That's Winston Lawrence, KD2, Whiskey Lima Lima, and Martin Maddy, Whiskey Kilo Zero Echo. Their kind donations, along with our monthly annual subscription donors, help us pay our way, and as they keep your ICQ podcast show advert-free. We hope you found value in today's show, just like the guys did, and will consider us by going to icqpodcast.com/donate, where, as I say, think of the value you got from the show. Is it the value of a cup of coffee, a sandwich, a burger, whatever it be? Turn it into a monetary figure and send it our way, and say it'd be greatly appreciated when you do that. We'd also like to thank the guys who helped take part in the news roundtables. So that's Dan, KB6 November Uniform, Karen, KD2 Golf Uniform Tango, Edmund, Mike Zero, Mike November Golf, and Ed, DD5 Lima Papa. So thanks, guys, for taking part in that news roundtable there. Right, we're just skipping through things here and trying to find anything else we missed. I think not. The only thing is a very important thing, because I know you've been out this morning promoting the hobby, and out as well tomorrow promoting the hobby. You'll be at the Dover Rally as we release this episode. So the most important thing to do is look after the lovely Mrs. B, hopefully with a cup of tea and something nice.
We certainly will, Colin. We'll find Mrs. B a nice cup of tea in a minute, and a chocky bicky, and yeah. Well, those who are going to be at the Dover Rally, I see there. It'll be a good one. I'm looking forward to it. So, yeah, good one. I'll say 73s, Colin.
Yep, 73s all. See you in a fortnight's time. Bye-bye.